Welcome to Men Are Nuts, a podcast about mental health, emotional health, physical health, awareness in men, women and society. First, it started with men, the acronym for Men Are Nuts. And we have a very special guest on the show for you today. Can you introduce yourself?
Hello, my name is Phil Fullen. I am currently in the state of Qatar in the Middle East. And I'm ex-Royal Air Force. I've been in Qatar for 10 years. I've worked in prison education. I've been self-employed. So I've had several different challenges.
Several different challenges. And we're both actually in Qatar because normally I do this via Zoom. So we're both in Qatar. And how are you finding the weather at the moment?
Weather's gorgeous.
You enjoying it?
I like heat.
Do you?
It's a bit difficult when you're outside during the day. I work as a safety manager in construction. So I'm on an infrastructure project, and shifts are normally 10-hour shifts. And as a safety manager, one of my main responsibilities is welfare. So welfare of the people on the site. We have just short of 2,500 people.
Wow.
So we have to make sure we have plenty of water, plenty of shelter, work rotation out the sun, to monitor the climate and everything. So it's being constantly aware of the change in the climate.
Yeah.
Especially this time of year.
Yeah. And Qatar, it's the home of next year's World Cup. Is that what you're building for? Is that what you're helping to build? Or is that part of the project?
I've worked on previous stadiums. My background, as electronics engineer in the Air Force, but also as like with most other people in the armed forces, you don't just have one role. You have many roles.
Yeah.
One of my leading roles for the last 12 years in the Air Force was health and safety management.
Right.
So when I came out after 22 years, I had a lot of experience and qualifications in health and safety.
Yeah.
Led me on to working within health and safety in the prison environment. So I worked in the prison in the West Midlands. And I was responsible for the health and safety of all the education staff and any of the inmates working within the education areas.
Yeah. And judging by your accent, you're not from the West Midlands, are you?
No.
I've been around a bit.
I'm from Geordieland, God's country.
For the listeners out there who don't know Geordieland, tell us about Geordieland.
Newcastle.
Whereabouts is Newcastle in terms of relation to the UK?
If you look at a map of the UK, from London, you follow the A1 directly north. It takes you up past Watford Gap, which is classed as the North-South Divide, up past Northampton, Nottingham, Sheffield, York. Further up from York, you've got Newcastle in the northeast of England.
Yeah.
And next step, getting to Northumberland and up to Edinburgh, into Scotland. So it's just south of Northumberland. It's part of Tyne and Wear.
Dare I say, the weather in Newcastle, completely different from the weather that we're in now.
A little bit different from everywhere normally. While I was doing my apprenticeship in Newcastle, I remember walking through 9 inches of snow for 7 miles to get to work.
Wow.
So I don't think we have the same sort of weather now as we used to.
Yeah.
It's not that often you get snow to that extent.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about Newcastle. What's it like there? What are the people like there?
There's been many surveys done on the people within the UK, people from Liverpool, people from Newcastle, London, West Midlands. So there's a lot of discussion about different types of personalities. And it's always come out that the people from the northeast are always the friendliest.
Yeah.
And we like to party. We like to have a good time.
Yeah.
And you go to Newcastle, it's, as you would imagine from the name, it's got quite a history. You've got the cathedral there, you've got a lot of castles, you've got a lot of castles in the area.
Yeah.
You've got Hadrian's Wall stretching from Newcastle across to Carlisle.
Yeah.
So there's quite a lot of history in the area.
Yeah.
But the people themselves, very relaxed, very laid back, very chilled.
Yeah. Apart from yourself being a comedian, I'd say you're a comedian. No, I would say that. I'm not saying that in a thing. I'm saying that in the nicest sense, because I always laugh at his jokes, by the way, guys. I'm always laughing at his jokes. And he is a funny man. What, apart from yourself, what famous things have come out of Newcastle? What, you know, talk about Newcastle brown ale.
Newcastle brown ale has to be the epitome, a bottle of dog, as we call it. So you got Newcastle brown ale. Football is, it's almost a religion in Newcastle. Though they've never won any competitions since 1969-70 when they won the first cup. And that's part of the reason I'm in the Middle East, because I was on a school trip. We went down to St James's, I held the first cup. Since then, they've won nothing, so I had to leave the country. That's why I'm here.
Now you know, the guys, you understand what I mean by is Jason. I'm sure he's going to be telling us a lot more as we go through the podcast. So, Newcastle, you here. What's it like in Qatar? We spoke about the weather. I mean, the weather's climbing up now. It's 37 at the moment.
It's normally where I work, because we're right in the middle of the desert, in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Normally 42, 43. When I was driving into work the other day, there was a monitor lizard, about 2.5 foot long, across the road in front of me. Quite often see sand vipers around the construction site.
Yeah.
So there's one or two hazards apart from just the welfare.
And apart from the driving as well.
The driving, it's not too bad.
I know. It's got better.
It's got a lot better, predominantly because the roads in this country. I've been here 10 years, and when we first got here, the roads weren't brilliant.
Yeah.
And the driving wasn't that good, and both have improved. The roads dramatically. The driving, not so at times.
Yeah.
Depends.
Yeah.
But a lot of the roads are either expressways or dual carriageways.
Yeah, yeah.
So the biggest manoeuvre you're ever going to make in this part of the world is a U-turn.
Yeah, yeah. And it's been built up a lot over the last, I mean, I've been here 9 years, and it's really changing. Even in Wakra, where I'm living, it's a lot of changes there, because obviously the stadium's there.
Yeah.
World Cup's here next year. How have you found this last year living in this so-called pandemic?
In the pandemic, it's been a little bit bizarre, because the project I'm on, it's what we in the UK would all class as mega projects.
Yeah.
You're normally looking at somewhere between 4 and 9 billion reals. Mm. So I've been on two metro projects, one stadium project, two highways projects, and now I'm on an infrastructure working with the American Air Force.
Yeah.
So the projects are worth a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I've never stopped working. Every day I still go to work.
Yeah.
Being the safety manager, I'm the focal safety person as well. So I have to deal with vaccinations. I have to deal with the medical centres. Mm-hmm. I have to deal with sanitisation. So whenever we get any outbreaks, I have to make sure everybody leaves.
Yeah.
We get the companies in to do the sanitising of the work areas, just to make sure it's not passed on.
Yeah.
And it's a policing of it. Because of the state that we're in, the state of Doha, state of Qatar, sorry, you have to wear a face mask.
Right.
It's not optional. Like, there's a lot of places around the world, you can wear it if you want, you don't have to wear it. We get roadblocks here, quite often they stop. We have an application on the mobile phones called Etiraz.
Yeah.
And the Etiraz app is specific against you and identifies through your movement pattern, people you've been in contact with, whether you're safe to be outside, so if you have a green Etiraz, or if you're red, you should be in quarantine, means you're positive, or you've got grey and yellow, so either you're quarantined or you're waiting for the outcome of a test.
Yeah.
So the Etiraz thing over here, it's an invasive app, which most people in the UK would complain about, because it has access to phone numbers, to contacts, to photographs. And the police can stop you and demand to see your Etiraz.
Yeah.
If you're caught without Etiraz, or if it's red, 10,000 rial fine.
Mm.
10,000 rials in pounds sterling is £2,000.
Yeah.
So you get caught, you're going to pay a lot of money.
How have you found it like last year, beginning of last year, during the restrictions, and how have you found it with you know your family and everything like that? How have you found your has it affected you mentally, or is it you just kind of got on?
I think being ex-forces, I've been used to these sorts of things before.
Yeah.
You know, things where we have to wear respirators for days. Yeah. And we have to wear MBC suits that are charcoal lined. And,
yeah.
You know, I've been in situations that a lot of civilians have never been in.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things that, you know, really, they don't faze me. They say, wear this, and okay, how long for?
Yeah.
So yeah. We come from a background where we don't tend to question authority.
Yeah.
If somebody in authority says, do this, we say, okay.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's nice to know why.
Yeah.
Which, that was, it was always one of my issues in the forces. I'll give you an example. As one day, I was at a base in Northumberland, and I was asked by my boss to go around and measure all of the doors that were larger than 6'6" wide,
yeah,
and 6 foot high. So, being obedient, went round, measured all the doors.
Yeah.
And when I got back, gave all the information to the boss, I said, can I just ask one question? He said, of course. I said, why? He said, it's because of the SALT treaty. So the Russians want us to declare any doors,
yeah,
that could have any missiles behind them.
Right.
So these were deemed to be the nominal sizes. If you told me that beforehand, wouldn't have been an issue.
Yeah, yeah.
So you know why you're doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's one of my big things where if ever I ask anybody to do anything, I always explain to them why they're doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, apart from being electronics engineer in the forces, I also have a background in training and in teaching. So I have, yeah, a degree in teaching and I have a degree in safety.
Yeah.
So I have a variety of qualifications.
Yeah.
So because of my background and my experiences, it tends to lead me the way that I think, well, that happened to me and I didn't like it because, yeah, I didn't know this and I didn't know, yeah, that. So I like to make sure that people, if I ask them to do, yeah, something, they know why they're doing it.
Yeah. Yeah,
so there's a reason behind it.
Yeah, it's that treatment of somebody else,
yeah,
and not treating, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, during, because a lot of, you know, for a lot of families, a lot of families, as we know, in the UK, in around the world, as soon as everything got locked down last year, people struggled mental health, you know, because if you're talking about husband and wife or whatever, they sometimes it's like ships passing through the night. One person goes from one job, the other one,
yeah,
and then all of a sudden now they're all in the house.
Yeah.
How did you find it?
It wasn't that much of an issue because my work never stopped.
Yeah,
all the project being government sponsored projects. We kept on working.
So you kept on working all the way through?
I've never had a day off all the way through.
Right.
And also, I've never had a PCR test.
Yeah.
Because I've never been in a position where I've travelled anywhere, or I could have picked up COVID-19.
Yeah.
And anybody that is likely to be in contact with it, because of the job that I do and the information I have, I know that the groups, you look at the societies out here, because we have a massive migrant population and a lot of them live in, we call them labour camps,
yeah,
which it doesn't give a very good mental picture to most people when they think about labour camps.
The word labour.
Yeah, but what it is, it's worker accommodation. And part of my job is to carry out inspections as the welfare officer. So you do these inspections and there is quite strict standards within Qatar as to the type of accommodation that you have to provide for the workers.
Yeah, yeah.
So there can only be four-man rooms, no more than four-man to a room. They have to have at least 6 square meters to themselves. They have to have their own bed, bedding, their own locker, bedside lights, bedside cabinet, private bathroom facilities, drinking water, meals, and a varying menu set on their nationality, whether, yeah, they're Bangladeshi, Indian, Sri Lankan. So there's quite strict regulation. You listen to a lot of the media that say, oh, this has happened to the migrant workers and this has happened to the migrant workers. I've been here 10 years and I've worked with a lot of migrant workers.
Yeah.
And a lot of the things that the media come out with, it's what I call typical media. Why let the truth get in the way of a good story?
Yeah.
So the sensationalised things, just because they know it's going to sell papers.
Yeah.
And they say, look at Qatar, a very small country, they have a lot of money, they must not be treating people very well.
Yeah.
I haven't found that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting to get your point of view, because obviously we hear a lot of things to do with Qatar in the media. So let's talk about your sort of life journey, and because you've done a multitude of things. And
well, I'm what we in the forces used to call a scaly brat. So my dad was in the forces as well.
Yeah.
So I was born in a house in Newcastle, in my grandmother's house, my nana's house. And when I was about 3, we moved to Lincolnshire.
Mm.
So we were stationed in Lincolnshire. And then from there...
The Lincolnshire, the cathedral and the... that steep?
What we call Lincolnshire, we call it RAF Lincolnshire.
Right.
Because if you look at the county of Lincoln, it's flat.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of air bases there. Because you look at the Peak District, you look at the Lake District, Northumberland, they have a lot of hilly areas.
Right.
Whereas you look at Lincolnshire and East Anglia, it's completely flat.
Right.
So we have a lot of bases there. Predominantly, the threat came from that side of the world, from Europe and Russia.
Right.
So we have a lot of air bases in Lincolnshire and East Anglia.
That's interesting to know that.
All the radar stations are all down the East Coast.
Right, okay. So are they still there even today?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you look at the stations I could go to. You've got Saxavord, which is in the Shetland Islands.
Yeah.
Benbecula in the Western Hebrides. Buchan in Peterhead,
yeah,
just north of Aberdeen. Bulmer in Northumberland. Staxton Wold beside Scarborough.
Yeah.
Neatus Head, just outside Norwich,
and
Bishop's Court, just outside Belfast, and it gave you complete cover all the way around the east coast, around the north, and part way down the west,
right?
Because it wasn't perceived that the threat would come from America,
either
over the top or
across
from Scandinavia,
above
the Scandinavian side. So that's why a lot of the British defences were down that side, because that's where the threat was perceived.
Yeah.
So Lincolnshire has a lot of bases. And we lived there. From there, when I was 6, we moved to a place called RAF Butterworth, which is in Changi, in Malaysia.
Yeah.
So I was there for a year and a half. Then we moved, not Changi, it was Penang. Changi is down in Singapore.
What was that like to move, to be at that age, to be able to jump from the UK all the way to...
It was an adventure for you. You think about kids and the way they love adventures.
Yeah.
When I lived in Lincolnshire, I can remember me and my friends had a den where we got a 1 meter square piece of card, and we put it inside these nettles. The nettles were about 5 foot high.
Yeah.
So we flattened down the nettles, and that would be our den. We'd be hiding inside these nettles. Not the safest thing to do.
But then no one could get in.
Exactly.
No one dare get in.
And at the time, because of my dad's rank, we lived in the caravan on the airfield.
Yeah.
It was brilliant. We lived in the caravan
in
the big field with woods behind us. You think, well, it's an adventure playground for kids.
Yeah.
And so we had all these stories and running out of aircraft hangars and things like this.
So you kind of, even though your dad was, because obviously when some people don't want to follow in their dad's footsteps, but you actually grew up around.
I had the easiest decision in my life, because when people said to me, what do you want to do?
Yeah.
I used to say, same as my dad.
Yeah.
So he came out of the Air Force as an electronics technician.
Yeah.
I joined the Air Force, an electronics technician.
Yeah.
And because I didn't have the qualifications when I left school, I had to get my maths O-level, because I got a grade D and they wouldn't accept a grade C.
Yeah.
So I had to get that. I did an apprenticeship. I was fortunate enough to be an electronics apprentice at Eveready, and I was my dad's apprentice.
Yeah.
So I had the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
So I was very fortunate.
Yeah. So you kind of grew up...
Yeah.
For a lot of people, their aim is to... Their aim is to be something, but they don't grow up around that thing.
Yeah.
They just see...
I was focused. I knew where I wanted to go, what I wanted to do. I'm the only one out of 5 children that's moved away from home.
Yeah.
All the others are still within what you would call the apron strings.
Yeah.
So they still see my mum all the time. Unfortunately, my dad passed 7 years ago.
Yeah.
but I still see my mum 2-3 times a week.
Did any of your friends want to join that way? Was it just you?
It's me. So the friends I had, I joined the Space Cadets, the Air Training Corps.
Yeah.
So we used to go gliding and flying and shooting and things like that. And it was great when you're a teenager to go out firing rifles in an uncontrolled environment and going flying and gliding. You go to summer camps at RAF stations.
Yeah.
So you do all these adventure things. It was brilliant. And you know, it's a bit of a come down because when you join the Air Force, you don't get any of that. You fire a weapon once a year when you do your weapons training.
Yeah.
You can go flying and gliding if you're lucky enough to be in the place where there's somewhere nearby that does flying and gliding.
Yeah.
But you can only do it at weekends, so it's not part of your normal work.
Right.
And when I joined up, I was doing 15 months training because it was intensive training. It was a BTEC course.
Yeah.
So we did 3 years of BTEC training in basically 15 months. So it was very intensive training.
Yeah. So you were, in a sense, you would say that you've grown up around it, you were laser, almost like laser focus, and that's what you wanted to do.
Yeah, I knew exactly where I want to be.
And did your mum or dad say, right, no, it's not probably something that you want to do? Or...
Yeah, my dad said, you can join the Air Force, but you're not going to be a rocket. Because my dad was in the RAF regiment.
Right.
The nickname for RAF regiment is Rockapes.
Right.
And he was in the Queen's Colour Squadron for 5 years.
Yeah.
And the RAF regiment do all the ground defence. So the RAF is basically a technical force. Mm. So you've got people that are trained to high levels of, you know, technicians, operators, communications, highly advanced equipment.
Yeah.
But we're trained on weapons because you have to be able to defend the station should there be a need.
Yeah.
But if there was a heightened risk, to get the RAF regiment in, and they're the ones that do the same training as the soldiers in the army. So do all the different types of weapons, the hand-to-hand combat, all this sort of activities. That the rapier system, which was another part of my trade, rapier and bloodhounds, surface-to-air missiles.
Right.
And so he said, you do anything, but you join as a technician, you don't join as a rocket.
Yeah. And what did you actually want to do? Is that the job that you did going in, is that what you actually wanted to do, or was it a change? Or
I wanted to do electronics, and the trade I went into had three different specializations.
Yeah.
Had air defense electronics, which is what I did. It's basically all the heavy radars, surface to air missiles, airfields radars, which is all your air traffic controls, your all the things you see when you go to airports, little radar heads, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And you had telecoms. Telecoms, you do all the fiber optics, the satellite comms, the embassy posts. You know, that was classed as the cushiest job, the telecoms. You get a job in an embassy, you could have somebody working in the British embassy in Doha, where if they're lucky, they might work till 1 o'clock each day.
Yeah.
Sometimes they finish earlier than that.
Yeah.
It was always perceived to be a much easier life than the one we had.
Yeah.
But everything's different. I mean, one of the problems with telecoms trade, it was might have been an easier job.
Yeah.
But promotion was difficult.
Yeah.
Because people didn't want to move.
Yeah. So growing up around, you said you went to Lincoln, and then you went to Malaysia.
Went to Malaysia, then to Singapore.
Yeah. And what was that like to live there?
It's brilliant. We went back to Singapore, me and Shirley, a couple of years ago. There's a friend of mine that I met out here. He went to Malaysia to set up a training centre.
Yeah.
So we went to visit him, and Shirley wanted to see some of Malaysia and Singapore.
Yeah.
So we went down to visit, and he actually lived right in the straits between Singapore and Malaysia. So the last 2 days we spent in Singapore itself, and I remember the address that I lived when we came back. I left there 1969,
yeah,
May 1969. And I remembered the address. So going back to the airport, we had about 4 or 5 hours.
Yeah.
So I said to the taxi driver, I said, can you take me to this address? I said, you know where it is? He said, yes. It was actually beside the airport, because Changi Airport used to be RAF Changi.
Right.
So the airport that they have in Singapore now used to be the RAF station. So that's where I used to live.
Right, okay.
And he took me to this house, And bizarrely, the house was up for sale. So there was an old chap in there, opened the gate and let us go around.
Yeah.
So I actually took a load of pictures and videos.
Yeah.
And it's much smaller than I thought. Because when you're a kid, it's like
everything's, everything's big.
And I looked at the storm drains, they're all covered over. And I went, when we had monsoons, we used to sit in the storm drains and go shooting down them in our swimming trunks. And
yeah,
that was the street I learned to ride the bike when I was seven.
Yeah, yeah.
And you've got all these memories coming back in.
Yeah.
And I got the pictures and sent them to my mum. And to be able to go into the house that you were in as a kid, around the other side of the world, yeah, it's bizarre.
Yeah, yeah. So you, what was your teenage life like? What was you, I mean, have you always been so jovial and...
I've always been the same. One of the things about people in Newcastle, you've got a very quick wit.
Yeah.
You've got to come back with a line straight away. And especially once I started my apprenticeship, because I work with electricians and mechanics. And if you didn't come back with a line, you just got crucified. So you always had to have a quick wit.
Yeah.
I think I've always had that.
Yeah.
It's beneficial being the force as well, because the force is, we have a slightly dark sense of humour.
Yeah.
Similar to the emergency services, where a lot of things you see in life are not the sorts of things that most people would see. And the way you deal with it is you laugh at things that a lot of people wouldn't laugh at.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say to you as well, you know, the first time getting there, how did you feel for the first day joining? I mean, was it, you know, some people, you know, like being a footballer, you get to sign the contract.
Well, it was the first day of being a rebel, actually, because 19th of February, I went down to the attestation office to do my attestation. So you sign the contract and take the Queen's shilling. And then the following day, you go down to the station, they give you a rail ticket, you go down, get in the train. The train took us down to Newark Northgate in Lincolnshire.
Yeah.
The station where they did all the training for RAF male recruits was RAF Swindaby.
Right.
So we went down there, and there was a lad that was from the same estate as me that I knew. Now, he wasn't a friend of mine, but we knew each other because we were the same age. We played around the streets together. And his name was Ronnie. And we got in the train together. We're having a bit of a laugh.
Yeah.
We got down to Newark Northgate.
Yeah.
Got off the train, and there was no sign of any transports, because the transport should have been there to meet us.
Yeah.
So we're looking around, and I said to Ronnie, should pop in for a pint? So there was a bar there, so we popped in, had a couple of beers, and once we went in, there's about another 20 people came in as well. Yeah. This corporal turned up, and he had an eye patch on, and to say that he wasn't pleased might have been a bit of an understatement. So you're very polite when we're in the pub and asking us to get on the bus, and once we got on the bus, got ripped off a real strip. So, and that was my first day of rebellion, and that was even before I had a uniform.
Yeah. What's one of your kind of fondest memories, or a story you can tell from your childhood? Or have you got? I mean, you must have many.
Well, there's loads of them. And when I was in Singapore, I can remember the first time that I rolled my bike down the street, and my friend was holding my watch in case I fell off and broke it.
Yeah.
And because he could ride the bike, he was a bit upset because I could now ride the bike, so he wouldn't be able to. So he said, I'm going to keep your watch. So I'm not bothered, so I'm riding off down the road.
Yeah.
So it's things like that. There's a lot of different things that you remember. I remember when we were in Penang, and there was a small hill, a mountain, directly over the road from us. And we went walking up there one day, and it was me, my dad, my two sisters, and my brother, and went up this path.
Yeah.
And my dad had this stick, and I didn't know why until we got towards the top, and this golden eagle came down because it had a nest up there.
Right.
And obviously it thought we were going for its eggs. So my dad was fighting this golden eagle off while we retreated back down the hill. I don't think as many people can come up with stories like that.
Yeah, fantastic. And you're now, the first day, bit of rebellion, torn to strips.
Yeah.
Was there any point during that first week or first couple of weeks that you thought to yourself, you know what, this isn't for me, or is it?
No. As soon as I got there, I knew that's it. Because the blokes I worked with when I was doing my apprenticeship, what I did, I had to give 1 week's notice. So I put in my notice 1 week beforehand, but yeah, because I knew that at lunchtime, the HR manager was out at lunch.
Yeah.
I put it 2/3 of the way down her entry.
Yeah.
So it was the Thursday of the following week,
yeah,
when she finally got down this pile of mail, saw my letter, called me and said, you have to give me a week's notice.
Yeah.
I said, I gave you a week's notice. I put that in there last week. It's not my fault. You had a lot of other stuff there.
Yeah, yeah.
I said, you must have deliberately put that in there. I said, I put it in the HR manager's office. How it got in there, I don't know, but tomorrow's my last day.
Yeah.
And as soon as the lads found out, they said, you won't last 5 minutes. I said, there's no way you'll be able to take orders. It's strange because once you get there, you're allocated your accommodation, and then you have to go to clothing stores, yeah, get all your uniform,
yeah,
and you got to try your uniform on. You got your berry, you got to teach you how to wear a berry,
yeah,
teach you how to iron your trousers, how to iron your shirts, yeah, how to polish your shoes,
yeah,
everything that take you back to basics.
Right.
So everybody has the same skill level.
Yeah.
And the first 10 days, all you do is march, yeah, march, and march. And you do classes on general service knowledge, GSK.
Right.
So what this is, right, at the end of the first week, you do 7 days, you get a test on general service knowledge.
Yeah.
And you have to get over 80% to pass.
Yeah.
So we're all stood there on parade, the corporal's out the front, calling the names. Smith, 82, lucky. Williams, she's going through all these.
Yeah.
Got some Fullen. Where's Fullen? Hey, Corporal. See you at the end. I'm the only one that's failed. He got to the end. He said, where's Fullen? Here, Corporal. 100%, you can leave first. And is this when you start to learn the wind-ups that are going to happen over the next 20-odd years of your career?
Yeah, yeah.
Whenever the standing orders were, if there's ever any time you can wind somebody up,
yeah,
you got to do it.
Yeah.
And everybody gets stupid nicknames.
Yeah, yeah.
It's mandatory.
Yeah, yeah.
So it depends on your name. I'm reading a book at the moment by Joy Ellis, and it's about a detective inspector in Yorkshire with her detective sergeant. His name is Easter. His nickname in the army was Bunny.
Yeah.
Because of his surname.
Right.
So everybody gets that sort of name.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We used to have this young lad called King, and his nickname was Wan, for obvious reasons. Yeah. So it's a sort of leg pun you get all the time.
Yeah.
And it just becomes second nature, you expect it.
Yeah. So it wasn't at all intimidating that you know, because I know some people can go in.
I've seen it affect a lot of people.
And it can affect people.
There's people joined up, not so much when I joined, but a little bit after, that were expecting it to be a job, or a 9-to-5 thing.
Mm.
Because at the time, we didn't have any conflicts. It was before the Falklands conflict,
yeah,
before the Gulf or anything like that. So there wasn't really that much going on. And a lot of people saw that you went into work, you did your job, you went home. Where they lived in the single blocks, you lived in the married quarters, or you maybe lived in your own apartment or flat outside. And finish work, you go out for a meal, have a few drinks, whatever, go back, start work again next day. So once things started to get a bit hairy, once we had the Falklands conflict, people had to work 24 hours, get detached to other places, sit in the boat for 6 weeks, travelling down to the Falklands.
Yeah.
And that's when people thought, you know, I didn't join up for this. And it has to be a mindset. You know, if you're joining the forces, you're joining it because it's a way of life, it's not a job.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it's always been a way of life to me.
Yeah.
So I never had this problem. And this is where I did see issues. When I was in the Falklands, for some bizarre reason, I became the counsellor. I was the most sensible senior NCO on the mountain.
Right.
Which, for anybody that knows me, that's a little bit scary.
Yeah. Well, just before we go on to that part, let's talk about, because for those listeners out there that may not have known about the Falklands, where is the Falklands? What actually happened? I mean,
if you look at the Falkland Islands, Malvinas is what the Argentinians call them. So you look at the landmass of Argentina. If you look at the bottom right-hand side, so you look in the southeasterly direction, yeah. You've got two small islands there, East Falkland and West Falkland. Mm. And these are British islands. Mm. So all the residents there hold British passports.
Right.
So similar to if you look at the Canary Islands off the coast of Tunisia and North Africa.
Yeah.
They're all Spanish,
yeah.
Where it's nowhere near Spain.
Yeah.
And similar, there's French islands at miles from France.
Yeah.
We've all taken these small islands and the part of our countries, so that's part of the British Isles, even though it's all the way over there.
Yeah.
I believe because of mineral rights. So whatever minerals are found around the coasts of the Falklands,
yeah.
It gives the British an entitlement to them.
Mm.
Same as any other country. You have ownership there because it's part of your country. So that's the way it worked. And the Argentinians weren't best pleased about this. So they invaded in 1982. Mm. Sorry.
Mm.
They invaded the Falkland Isles. Maggie Thatcher sent a task force down there, predominantly by ship, because at the time we didn't have any air bases.
Yeah.
So sent the task force down there, which took a while to get there. It was a battle and a lot of people killed on both sides.
When did you say that started?
1982.
82,
wasn't it?
Yeah.
So I joined up in 1980. Mm. So I was still quite new to the Air Force then.
Yeah.
So you had this conflict, and then from there, decided to build up. So we've got several radar sites there, plus the airfield. And so there's still a lot of people down the Falklands now.
Mm.
Because it's still classed as part of the protected territories.
Mm.
So everybody, the Army do a 6-month detachment there, the Air Force do a 4-month detachment.
Yeah.
So I went down there for 4 months from December 98 to April 99. So I was down there over Christmas, New Year.
Yeah.
Kids' birthdays, Easter's, New Year, everything. So it can be difficult from that point of view. And at the time, we didn't have the technology we have now.
Yeah.
So nobody had mobile phones. We had communications via internet, but through line of sight.
Right.
Because communications is part of my trade.
Yeah.
Line of sight is where you've got a transmitter and a receiver that can actually see each other. So what they did on East Falkland, they put a transceiver. On West Falkland, they put a transceiver.
Right.
So transceiver is a transmitter receiver.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they had to have line of sight so you could be able to have the connectivity.
Yeah.
Trouble is, it's similar to the Western Hebrides.
Yeah.
It gets a bit breezy. So there's sometimes you find these are moving, and if they're not moving together, you're going to lose your comms.
Yeah.
So we had that on a regular occasion.
Yeah. How did you find the fact that I can't really remember it, but I didn't really know the ins and outs of it. How did you find? What was it? In fact, let's go back to where you kind of first found out that you were, Britain were going to go to war. What was that? What was that? Your feelings like for that?
You just do what you do. I mean, I wore the uniform. Everybody that joins the armed forces signs a blank check.
Mm.
And basically, the blank check is that you're willing to give your life for your country.
Yeah.
That's the top bottom of it.
Yeah.
So anybody that signs up, that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
So whatever happens, it's your choice.
Mm.
There's no conscription. So if you've decided to do that, you've got to understand that at some point in the future, this may happen. Mm. So just get on with it.
Yeah. So you just, so even when it first kicked off, were you kind of like, oh, this is going to happen, I better be weary, or, what was your thoughts on it?
The thing is, it was 16,000 miles away.
Mm.
So first thought was, well, it's a long way away.
Yeah.
So that's not really going to affect me.
Yeah.
Unless you're actually on the road to go down there.
Yeah.
So I've known people that have gone there several times. I only went there once, so I was fortunate. I've known some people that have been there 4 or 5 times.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is what you make it.
Yeah.
It's like any detachment. You're away from home. you don't have all your own things around you. You know, you might live in an accommodation where you've got a stereo, TV, you've got societies or clubs you're part of.
Yeah.
You get thrown to another country. I mean, we were at the top of a mountain, surrounded by barbed wire fence, and there's 35 people there, and you got in by helicopter, you got out by helicopter.
Mm.
So it's, that side of it was strange anyway.
Yeah.
But again, it's what you make of it. It's doubt on mindset. I had people there that I had to take for a walk, do a bit of counselling, and try to get them to understand what they were doing, why it was important, and how they were feeling was understandable, but they had to be able to get a grasp of it. And that's the thing, you know, just because you're missing your wife or you're missing your girlfriend doesn't mean that they're not missing you.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean it's not natural. Yeah. It is a natural thing to be going through.
Yeah.
But you have to understand that when you joined up, this was a real possibility that you're going to have to go to a situation that it might not be comfortable.
Yeah.
But when you look at it, where you are now, it's a safe environment, apart from the fact that the Argentinians could come over the hill.
Yeah.
We had a gym, we had a jacuzzi, sauna. We'd made a 9-hole golf course where you chip the ball across ISO containers.
Yeah.
We had mountain bikes so you could cycle down the hill. We had fishing rods so you could go down there fishing. So not only was the work side of it, there was also the leisure side of it.
Yeah.
So, and everything's what you make of it.
Yeah.
So if you wanted to, I mean, I used to do a lot of hill walking.
Yeah.
So I'd go out hill walking, swimming in the sea.
Yeah.
It was 8 degrees. 3 Adam's apples. That wasn't pleasant. Come out with your voice 4 octaves higher, talking like Mickey Mouse. But I mean, it's exactly the same as being on the Western Hebrides.
Yeah.
If you've ever been to Skye or Islay or Benbecula or any of these islands, everything's like that. Nothing grows above 18 inches because of the wind.
Yeah.
And it's just exactly the same landscape.
Yeah. So in a sense, how were you then kind of assigned to be, or did you kind of just take it on board yourself to be a counsel, you know, to counsel people? Where did that come from?
I used to be heavily involved in the church.
Right.
I used to, I was a Sunday school teacher, which a lot of people get a guffaw as soon as I say that.
Yeah.
And you get the normal response, what, you? And I was a Sunday school teacher and a Eucharistic minister. So when I was stationed in Germany, I got permission from the Bishop of the Armed Forces to be able to deliver Mass as a Eucharistic minister.
Yeah.
And basically, what we did, because we're on an active station, the padre, who's a Catholic priest, Saturday evenings, we used to have Mass for people who were working on the Sunday because we had 24-hour duties. So the Eucharistic ministers would take it in turn to do the Saturday evening so that the padre could do the Sunday.
Yeah.
And the bread and the wine, the host and the body and blood of Christ, they were consecrated the previous week and kept in the sacristy.
Right.
And part of the reason is so if the priest has to deliver the last rites to anybody during that week, he then doesn't have to bless the host. So we had that, so we'd use up what was left from the previous week, and then when we had the Mass the next day, the priest would then bless the body and the blood again.
Yeah.
So we used to take that, we'd do that Mass so he didn't have to work every single weekend.
Right.
Because people think it's an easy job being a padre. You've got, what we used to say, you've got an easy job, you work one day a week, you've got one AP, an air publication, and no amendments. Because you're not going to get any amendments to the Bible.
Right.
So we used to always have the standing joke with the padre. But and I was very heavily involved, actively involved. And I don't know what it is, but people, for some reason, just open up to me.
So that gravitate towards you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's always happened. I don't know why, I don't know how. But, I mean, one example, me and Shirley went for an eye test at an optician's in Birmingham, and she went in, she was in there 10 minutes, came out. I went in, came out 40 minutes later. She said, what the the hell was happening? So it was telling me about the kids' problems and the divorce and financial worries. Said, why does it always happen to you?
Just have the knack for it. Yeah. People get drawn to it.
I'm good at listening.
Yeah.
I can talk.
Yeah.
But I did a listening skills course with the chaplaincy. We used to do a lot of training on different aspects of the forces. And one of the biggest things was being able to listen.
Yeah.
And
it's always a good thing.
Yeah. But you tend to find that one of the hardest things for any person to do is to be quiet.
Yeah.
Because if we're sat here now and you wanted to keep saying things, it'd be difficult for me to talk. But sometimes it's difficult for somebody to talk to someone and start opening up. But then if you keep interjecting, they're not going to
take it
further. So yeah. One of the most difficult things is when you're having a conversation with somebody, it's when they stop talking, you feel like you want to start talking.
Yeah.
And it's one of the things I've learned is you don't. You sit there, just be quiet, just be calm.
Yeah.
And then they'll get the courage to carry on.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're kind of talking about all the things that you said you had a great childhood, but is there anything that you've came across that you've come up against in your life, that we all do, that you've had to, that's kind of tested your mental, you know, has anything been, I'm sure there've been many things, but you know, like you say, because I was just wondering, because if one of the questions I was going to ask as well is, how did that affect your relationship with your peer, with your mum, or, you know, if you might not have wanted you to go?
Yeah. Because we were scaly brats, my mum was used to it.
Mm.
She knew I was going to join the forces.
Mm.
So she knew it was always going to happen.
Yeah.
So it was always accepted that's the way it would be.
Yeah.
So I think she knew. And I mean, I was very fortunate in the fact that once I finished my 6 weeks basic and then my 15 months trade training, I got posted back to Northumberland.
Mm.
So I was 40 miles up the road.
So not far away.
So I worked, for the first 9 months I was on day shift. So I'd work 8 till 5, have the evenings and the weekends myself.
Yeah.
So what I used to do was on a Friday evening, I'd walk from the station down to Alnmouth, which is 2 to 3 miles.
Yeah.
Walk down there, couple of beers in my bag, still in uniform, because in those days we could still travel in uniform before all kicked off too much with the conflict we had. And I used to go home every weekend. And it's bizarre because I don't know if you have brothers or sisters, but I have 3 sisters, 1 stepsister and 1 brother. So I've got 1 older sister, then I'm second, my brother's third, then my 2 other sisters.
Yeah.
And me and my brother, we were like cat and dog. I think all brothers are. Always fighting, screaming at each other.
Yeah.
We had to share a bedroom, so that always causes problems when you're grown up.
Yeah.
But my dad said once, I came back for the weekend and me and my dad got out for a pint. And he said, you know, you're Stephen. Biggest thing he looks forward to every week is you coming home on the Friday so you can go out for a drink with you.
Mm.
And we never had that sort of relationship before I joined.
Yeah, yeah.
So that it brought us closer.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's strange how that's happened.
Yeah. So during your time in the Air Force, and you did you ever come across anything that, you know, that would have affected you mentally, or have you always kept a...
I've been very fortunate in the fact that I don't really do stress.
Mm.
And I think maybe because of my religion that I had at the time.
Yeah.
I don't have that now, but at the time I had that. I always found it calming to just go in the church.
Yeah.
So at any time where I thought things were starting to build up, I'd just go and sit in the church, light a couple of candles and sit there. Think nothing, do nothing, and just let everything just sort of seep out of me.
So that was your kind of coping mechanism then, to kind of go to this?
I've always loved going around churches, cathedrals, abbeys, places like this, stately homes. Yeah. I've always loved looking at them, and I get lost in them.
Yeah.
So I think that's one of my ways of dealing with things. You know, just find somewhere where I let all this just ooze away.
Yeah. Did you ever come across any, you know, growing up until that point, did you ever come across any, because you were a counsellor, did you ever come across anybody counselling you for things that have traumatic experiences and then you having to counsel them through?
Yeah, I've had a couple of situations with friends.
And how did that affect you? Because if you're quite jovial and then you're having to put on this, it's almost like a straight face to kind of help them, how that?
It's knowing when to turn it on, when to turn it off.
Yeah.
You know, there's times when you can make a joke out of something and times when you can't.
Yeah.
I mean, an example is a mate of mine, Jock McLeish. We were in Western Supermud on our training course back in 81. And went down the local pub, because we love going down to Western on the weekends. Went down the pub, having a couple of beers, and I saw Jock, said, "How's it going, Jock? How are you doing?"
Yeah.
He said, "Oh, not good." "Okay," I said, "I'll get you a beer." So I got him a beer. I said, "Anything you want to talk about?" And bear in mind, I'm at 20, 21 at the time.
Yeah.
First year in the Air Force. So I said, "Anything you want to say?" He said, "Just found out that your brother's just been killed by the IRA." Mm-hmm. He said, "That's the second one." There isn't any words.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you just know that no matter what you say, anything you say is going to make it worse.
Yeah.
So just put my arm around him, just stood there. And just that the fact he knew that there was somebody there, and there was somebody concerned.
Yeah.
But I don't know why, but I've always been like that. I don't know how it's happened or whatever. But I'm very much like my dad. My dad was very much the same.
Yeah.
So maybe I've got it from him.
Yeah. How do you see your time in the Air Force? What was it? Do you find it was a happy time in your life, or do you find it what?
Ups and downs. I mean, I was divorced 3 times.
Yeah.
So there's always things that are going to test you. And they say the things that are most difficult in your life is getting divorced and moving house.
Yeah.
I've moved house 13 times in 12 years.
Wow.
And, I mean...
Being able to cope with that, moving around 13 times, and do you think that's kind of... How can I put it?
Just gives you that acceptance. You just say, "Oh yeah, I'll just move again." One of the biggest differences, and I always say this between veterans and civilians, is that civilians might live in the same house for 20, 30 years and never move. Whereas, you know, I might be in a house for like 10 months, right, you have to move there because we're going to renovate this. So you just pack it all up, move it, unpack it, that's it.
Yeah.
So it became not so much an art form, but it's an accepted thing. You think, "Oh, I've got to move. When?"
So it's almost like a normality for you then, in a sense, because even when you were a child, you moved.
Yeah.
You moved, you had to move.
Well, I went from Newcastle to Lincoln, to Malaysia, to Singapore, back to Newcastle, back to another part of Newcastle.
Yeah.
And that was possibly the longest I've been in one place, from when I was 11 to when I was 19.
Yeah.
So all of my teenage years were in the same house.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so it's almost like you travelled when you were young, and it's almost that thing of... You know, getting used to it, and then you travel during the Air Force. I mean, during the Air Force, then what countries did you travel to?
Well, I've been England, Ireland, Wales, Scotland, France, Belgium, Holland, Germany, Spain, Italy, Ascension Islands, Falkland Islands. Denmark.
So they were all kind of in all assignments and
different places where I'm working.
Yeah, yeah.
That's without looking at holidays, you just get everywhere.
Yeah. And which countries do you find to be the most open or friendly or not, which one was open? That's not to say anything about any of those countries, but how did you feel around that time being a British, someone in the knowing that the Falklands are on and all these sort of things, people know, people's feelings towards British or whatever.
I always enjoyed where I was, because wherever I went there to enjoy it.
Yeah.
So I used to travel back and forwards to Aylesbury, just outside Aylesbury, every month while I was living in Germany.
Right.
So I'd travel from Germany into Holland, into Belgium, into France, and across Calais to Dover.
Yeah.
So I did that journey many times, and Holland and Belgium, they're just so laid back.
Yeah.
But then I went up to Denmark, and Denmark's laid back but expensive.
Yeah.
You go to Germany, and Germany's different, but it's so beautiful.
Yeah.
You travel around different parts of Germany, and it's a different world between the north and the south.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been to Germany. Is it the Rhine, is it?
Yeah.
And on the Rhine and kayaking on the Rhine.
I mean, the only time I've been to Italy, I was detached there with the force, one of the jobs I had. And I was very fortunate because my job, specialist job, so there was only me that could do it. And once I'd done that job, I was there for 5 days. After 2 days, I'd finished the work.
Yeah.
So I said, there you go, there's a car. There's a fuel card.
Yeah.
Just remember, if they flash the lights, it means they're coming, they're not stopping.
Yeah.
And I got to see places like Alberobello.
Yeah.
And Castellana Grotto. Castellana Grotto is where Our Lady was meant to be seen.
Yeah.
So it's quite a religious place.
Yeah.
When I was in Germany, there's a place just abroad called Kevlar. And Kevlar had the Basilica, which again is where Our Lady was meant to be seen.
Yeah, yeah.
So for some reason, I seem to gravitate towards these places that have this religious significance.
Yeah. Did you go anywhere where people took offence to you or didn't like because of, this place in the world and you being wearing the uniform?
Yeah, it's normally a place called the United Kingdom. So this problem every time the locals didn't like the servicemen, because the servicemen had good jobs, were all trained, had short hair, normally smart, and used to go downtown. You had money to spend, which a lot of the locals might not have had.
They
might not have been working, whereas we're in the forces, we're getting a reasonable salary. So the girls used to always come to us, so a lot of the times you went to the local towns, it was always battles,
it's all fights and stuff like that.
Always away. But then you get it, you look at the army, and the army have battles between themselves, depending on which regiment you're in. Mad as a box of frogs.
That's the first time I've ever heard that. That's the first time I'm hearing that.
Yeah.
And that's actually an interesting point.
Big problem.
Yeah.
I remember getting chased out to Lossiemouth, and it was at the times where I used to wear the bell-bottom trousers with the big waistband and the platform shoes.
Yeah, the 70s.
Run down the road, platform shoes in your hand, you think, this is a bit wrong. Getting chased by hairy horse jocks.
So what made you come out of the? Was it just time, or was it just?
I should have been in. I PVR'd. PVR is premature voluntary release. I just got to the point where I hadn't been promoted. I got promoted to sergeant within 10 years.
Yeah.
I applied for a commission a couple of times. Hadn't got through. Hadn't got picked up for promotion to my next rank, which was chief technician, which my fourth assessment as a sergeant, I got special recommendation and AOC's commendation.
Yeah.
And I got LSGCM, Long Service Good Conduct Medal.
Yeah.
So you think all of these things, big ticks in the box, I'm automatically going to get picked up.
Yeah.
Didn't get picked up because we amalgamated the trade, so I went into one of these comms jobs and everything changed. And 5 years later, I'm still sat there at the same rank.
Mm.
By this time, I'd done the HNC in electronic engineering.
Yeah.
I had my cert ed, just about finished my bachelor's in further adult higher education.
Yeah.
I had an NVQ4 in training development. And so I had a lot of qualifications that I could use. And I thought, you know what? I've had enough of this now.
Mm.
If they're not going to promote me, I'm going to go somewhere else where they will.
Yeah. Yeah, so, do you think you fell out of love with it then, or because of things, the changes, and because not promotion? And
partly promotion, but partly because it went pink and fluffy. All of the discipline that we used to have because of the snowflakes, you couldn't have it anymore. You're not allowed to shout at people.
You're not allowed to say snowflake, are you?
Probably not, no.
I'm just making...
What we used to have to do, if you're doing an inspection of somebody and they have some fluff on their uniform, we used to shout at them at like 420 decibels, about an inch from the rear. But you're not allowed to do that. You have to say, excuse me, but I'm going to touch you to take some fluff off your uniform.
Just in case this happens and this happens.
So I played it the other way around and I just said, I'm sorry, went to my flight side, I said, I'm sorry, I don't want to do any more parades. What do you mean you don't want to do parades? I said, I feel very uncomfortable. Why? I said, well, the parades are mixed and I don't feel comfortable standing inspecting the females. And I don't feel comfortable doing that, so I don't want to do it anymore. And he just burst out laughing. So I sent him an email, just copied in the flight commander. The flight commander called me and said, what's this? I said, I'm sorry, sir, but I don't want to do that. I feel very uncomfortable doing that. And if you push me to do it, I said, I'm quite happy to take extra key duties, but I don't want to do that anymore. And because of the nature of the forces then, they had to let me get away with it. And the boss saw me, because I used to go running a lot at the time. That was at the time when I did a triathlon. So you look at me now, I couldn't even spell triathlon. He spoke to me, we're out running, he said, that thing about the parades. I said, yeah, I was just fed up with doing them, so I just thought I'd wind Andy up. Andy was my flight sergeant. He said, you're the only person I know that's got the balls to do that. So works both ways, doesn't it? You know, if you give us the snowflake stuff, we give you the snowflake stuff back. Fair's fair.
So you fell out of love, you just had enough, and what was that last day like, leaving and kind of getting out? And
it's strange because I had 3 months of terminal leave and resettlement leave and things like that. So it's a weird transition because I was working, I was the focus for Trade Group 3 Modern Apprenticeships, MVQs and Key Skills. And there was a civilian company that was working with us that was just starting to expand. So this civilian company took me on as a consultant. So I actually left the Air Force, and from the 3 months that I was working, doing my resettlement, I was working in the same office, in civilians, with the same people, doing the same job. So I spent 2 years as a consultant with this company, working with the same people, doing the same job, going to the same places, just as a civilian instead of a sergeant.
So
I had a very easy transition.
So,
like I said, I've always been, there's always someone been looking down on me and thinking, we'll make that a little bit easy for me.
Did you feel at all emotional or sort of like, you know, it's a career that your dad's been in, you're not being promoted and all these sort of things. Did you ever feel like, oh, you know what?
I just got to the point where it wasn't the Air Force that I joined. And I just got fed up with it. It's just getting ridiculous.
And what's the next stage of your journey? Next few stages?
Well, after I did that job for 2 years, and then this company lost the contract with the Air Force, so I was out of work. And at the time, I was one of the few people in the country that knew about Key Skills. So it's still quite a new initiative. And there was a local college was advertising for Key Skills lecturers. So I applied for this job and got the interview. So I phoned up the education manager. It turned out that it was within the secure estate. Because the way that prison education works, it's not run by prison officers the way it used to be. It's now run as an education department, which follows all the Ofsted rules. So they still have Ofsted inspections, exactly the same as schools and colleges. And all of the staff that are doing the delivering have to be suitably trained. So it's exactly the same as you would get in the college down the road, except it's behind the walls. So I phoned them up, told them who I was, explained this is what I've done, blah, blah. He asked me a few questions on Key Skills. I gave him the answers. Went in a couple of weeks later for the interview. He asked me exactly the same questions. I gave him exactly the same answers. He I said, yeah, I've got no problems. And then when I got to know him, he was an ex-sergeant marine, came from the northeast of England, served 22 years in the forces.
Right.
I was an ex-sergeant technician,
yeah.
Came from the northeast of England, served 22 years in the forces.
Yeah.
And it's a better society than the Masons.
Yeah.
If you're ex-armed forces, every single job I've had since I left the forces
yeah.
is because I was in the forces.
Yeah.
So it's...
So it's giving you a foot in the door.
Yeah. Because everyone that employs you is ex-forces themselves.
Yeah.
And one of the things they know is that if you're ex-forces, you have a specific standard that you work to.
Yeah.
Now, if you say that there's a meeting at 10 o'clock, you'll be there for 5 to 10.
Yeah.
If you come to a meeting, you're going to be dressed appropriately.
Yeah.
You're going to conduct yourself appropriately. And they're not going to have any of the problems best that about, you
yeah.
can get.
Yeah.
So the fact that you've got this history... excuse me. Means, yeah, there you go, there's a job, on you go.
What was prison life like?
It was interesting. It was very interesting.
Is that where you met?
Yeah. I met my wife in prison.
You sure did it?
Yeah.
So you met her in prison?
Yeah, it's a great life.
Was she a prisoner?
She spent 13 years in prison. There's people got less for murder. I was there for 6 years.
Yeah.
But Shirley was my boss.
Yeah.
Still is.
Yeah.
But we dealt with vocational skills.
Yeah.
So MVQs, key skills, health and safety, manual handling, all these sorts of things it did on the work areas of the prison.
Yeah.
So you got the education department, which is all the classrooms.
Yeah.
Which is where they do the English, the maths, the ICT, things like that.
Yeah.
I did all the key skills and the health and safety.
Yeah.
So also forklift truck driving. I learned to be a forklift truck instructor.
Right, okay.
While I was in there.
Yeah. So what kind of boss was Miss Shirley? What kind of boss was she? Was she regimental?
Exactly the same as now, but she's wiser now. And I'm the dimwit of the family, because everybody else has master's degrees. I only have 4 bachelor's degrees.
Your time in the prison. What, you know, like the first day of going in?
Yeah.
You know, we often see it on TV shows or whatever. Mm. You know, I know TV shows aren't our thing, but some of it can be based on... I mean, we have documentaries. You see them rattling the thing when you're walking through. I mean, what was your time like in there?
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Most of the prison officers, or the screws... were ex-forces, and because I actually worked in the workshops or the kitchens or the library, and I integrated education into the workplace,
yeah.
as opposed to people coming into a classroom and doing education.
Yeah.
So I integrated what they were doing. So an example, the key skills, with 4 trades there: bricklayers, carpenters, painter and decorators and plumbers.
I've still got some. Thank you.
So they can choose which trade they want to go into.
Yeah.
And then they did the course, and the course could be maybe 6 months long. So during that 6 months, they've got tradesmen from South Birmingham College that come in to teach them the trade. I used to go in one session a week and integrate English and maths into it.
Right.
So coming from a safety background, the English was easy, so we'll get the MSDS, the Material Safety Data Stream.
Yeah.
So if you're using a paint, a gloss paint is going to be more hazardous than the emulsion paint.
Yeah.
Because emulsion might be water-based, where gloss paint might give off fumes.
Yeah.
So how you use it is important.
Yeah.
So we used to use that as the basis for the English.
Yeah.
So they'd understand a bit about English from using that. The maths, we used to say, right, if you want to work for yourself and you come into a room like this and you're a painter, so right, you need to give a quotation for this room.
Yeah.
How much would you charge to paint this room? 500 quid. Okay, 500 quid. So what's that based on? It's a good number. Say, but are you likely to get a job if you just throw a number at somebody?
Yeah.
Nah. So how could you demonstrate that you know what you're actually doing?
Yeah.
How can you demonstrate that you can give them a reasonable quote based on your knowledge.
Yeah.
Dunno, Gov. I said, well, first of all, you look at the size of the room, and it's a big room, and you've got walls each side, so you need to figure out, right, how big are these walls?
Mm.
So how are we going to do that?
Yeah.
Use a tape measure. Oh, good idea. So are we going to measure in feet and inches, or are we going to use meters and millimeter? Don't know, Gov. Do you know the difference between them? Then they understand how they need to look at metric and imperial,
yeah,
which measurement they're going to use.
Yeah.
And then once they've done that, you've got a linear measurement, but you need to make it into a cubic measurement or a squared measurement. So if you look at this wall, you've got 6 meters length, 3 meters height, 6 times 3 is 18.
Yeah.
But it's not 18 meters because that's just one straight line.
Yeah.
It's 18 meters squared because you're using two numbers.
Yeah.
So you explain it to them that way. So then you work out, so right, we've added all that up. Right, is that how much paint you need? Yes, Gov. What about the doors and what about the windows? You're not going to paint them with the same paint you're going to use for the walls, are you?
No.
No, Gov. Well, so what we have to do is measure them and take that away so we can say, well, that's how much we need for the walls, but we're going to have to do the doors with white gloss or cream gloss.
Yeah.
So that's it. So where are you going to get these prices? I don't know. So, well, we've got these catalogues from Wix and we've got prices of everything in there.
Yeah.
So we got them to then do like a mini project.
Yeah.
So you teach them the maths side of it. You teach them the English side of it with the safety. And then you teach them how to put together a quotation.
Yeah.
So, right, if you came to my house and said, yeah, I'll measure it all up, I'll come back tomorrow with a quote, and you give me something like that that shows you worked out exactly how much material you need, the brushes and rollers, because the client pays for them, and then £100 labour, because it's going to take you 2 days, I'm not going to argue, because you've shown me that you know what you're doing, and you're not charging something extortionate.
Yeah. So you're basically going into the prison system to kind of help.
To rehabilitate.
To rehabilitate and help.
And it's funny because we sat outside our local chip shop in Birmingham where we lived at the time, and there was a knock on the window. There was this young girl at the window.
Mm.
So we wound the window down. She said, is your name Phil?
Mm.
I said, yeah. So my boyfriend wants a word with you. Oh, yeah. And it was one of the lads that was in my class in the prison.
Yeah.
He'd come out. It's one of the other things I did with the CSCS card. Construction Skills Certification Scheme.
Yeah.
And you need the CSCS card to get on any construction site.
Right.
So we used to do this with them, so they all left with this CS card.
Yeah.
So worst case scenario, they can work onto any construction site.
Yeah.
And he said, if it hadn't been for that, I wouldn't have got my first job in construction. So I got some money, and I've now set up my own car maintenance business.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's got a little van, and he's got tools and that in the back.
Yeah.
So he said, if it hadn't been for you doing the CS card with me, I wouldn't have been working for myself now.
Yeah. So you've done a good job then.
Yeah.
So it's almost like you've taken the counselling from years ago and implemented it within that, and that job just being you.
Yeah.
Was there any time during your... you've told me some stories before and stuff like that, but was there any time where you felt intimidated or being in prison system, or there was anything that... give some juicy stories of anything that might have kicked off.
There's a couple of times. I mean, there's once, I was in one of the workshops, and this workshop made laundry bags.
Yeah.
You know, the net bags you have with the zip? They used to make the laundry bags for all the prisons. So what they'd do is, you've got all the materials, so you've got to cut the material, you've got to use the sewing machine, you've got to get the zip, and you know, there's a lot of quality control and everything. And there's some officers in there that oversaw that, because obviously they're using scissors, and you've got the security aspects.
Yeah.
And there's one day, it kicked off in there. So the two officers were in the middle of this fight, because obviously they need to get scissors off people.
Yeah.
They need to make sure there's no serious injuries.
Yeah.
And one of the officers, when he went down, his radio came off his belt and went underneath the table. So he couldn't get to his radio to hit the alarm.
Yeah.
And every wall had an alarm button on it.
Yeah.
So they're busy dealing with this. I went over, hit the alarm bell. Then, because I had my own keys, comes over the tannoy, general workshop six.
Yeah.
So everybody heads across to workshop six because they have a response team of officers from different parts of the prison.
Mm.
They all head across because obviously it kicks off.
Yeah.
You've got people there to deal with it. So yeah. I was stood there at the gate with the key. So you hear the boots coming up the stairs. So I had the gate open. Get officers came in,
yeah.
Got these cons, dragged them out.
Yeah.
And I mean, that was the first time I'd had that sort of situation.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wasn't directly involved.
Yeah.
But I put myself into it to help the officers out.
Yeah.
But also, just to stop anybody else getting injured.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's that. But there's another situation. We're having a tea break. Again, we're out workshop boys. And these boys start to get a bit punchy and everything. They start pushing each other around. So I just stood up in the middle of them, just pushed them apart. Yeah. I said, look, don't mess about. There's cameras up there. I get in trouble. You get in trouble.
Yeah.
You get banged up in solitary.
Yeah.
Pack it in now.
Yeah.
So there's a couple of times I've got in the middle of it.
Yeah. And that would be down to your training in...
It's just confidence that you know you can deal with the situation.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we used to do breakaway training of if you got attacked, how to deal with it and that.
Yeah.
And again, there was me and this education manager. We were doing this breakaway training together once.
Yeah.
And the person doing the training wore cricket pads. And what you used to do is you'd curl up on the floor and you had to protect your head. So you put your arms up in front of your face and they'd be kicking you. And most people just doing gentle tap like this. He said, we're going to go for this. I said, well, if we're going to do it, we're going to do it properly, aren't we?
Yeah.
We're kicking shit out of each other.
Yeah, yeah.
So both of us, for 2 weeks, we had black and blue arms.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody else stopped and just watched us. And the prison officer came over at the end and said, you two are mad. But strange things like that. You know, these are the things you remember that make you laugh.
Yeah, yeah. And so... You've lived a kind of, great
gifted
life and gifted and kind of enjoyed yourself, and a lot of that is down to thing. But earlier you mentioned that, is it 7 years ago did somebody pass away?
Yeah, my dad died 7 years ago.
What, if we're talking about, you know, our health and things that affect us, how was that? I mean,
that was hard because I've always been close to him.
I'm sorry to cut you there, because I would suggest that would be hard because you've already painted a picture of you being you almost say your dad being your hero. I'm not saying your mum thinking, but your dad has been your hero from a young age.
I'll give you two examples. When I was at school, we were in an English class, and our English teacher, Mr. O'Kane, Doc O'Kane, he gave us an essay to write on the man you admired the most.
Mm.
Now, bear in mind, at the time you had Muhammad Ali, you had Kenny Dalglish, you had Kevin Keegan, you had Malcolm McDonald, all these superstars of sport.
Yeah.
And I wrote about my dad, the man I admired the most.
Yeah.
And that was it. And then when I worked in Eveready, when I was doing my apprenticeship, my dad's nickname was Flew because his previous nickname was Fluellen because the surname's Fullen.
Yeah.
So the lads changed it to Fluellen.
Yeah.
And eventually shortened it to Flu. So he was Flu.
Yeah.
Automatically I became Young Flu.
Right.
So that was, to me, that was an honour that. You're Young Flu.
Yeah. So it's almost like you because as a child, you're seeing this person who's tall, wearing a uniform, coming back, and you're almost hero. Yeah, he's hero worshiping.
I mean, the other things I remember is when we're in Singapore, Changi, he was on the committee of the Families Club. So at the time, he was a ground electrician.
Yeah.
So he used to do electrical works, but weekends and evenings, there was a lot of the locals that used to work doing all domestic jobs and that.
Yeah.
He'd go down and he'd put socket extension in and little bits and pieces, get some stuff from work.
Yeah.
You know, like if they're doing a job and there's like 5 meters of cable left over, they're not going to put it into stores. So go and put an extension in or something simple like that.
Yeah.
A little job. And I remember getting invited to a Chinese wedding because my dad, he's held in such esteem by everyone because he was always helping people.
Yeah.
and we went to this wedding, and I remember we're sat at this meal and I've got a chopstick in each hand thinking, how does this work? If you're eating spaghetti hoops, it's not a problem, but when you're eating rice, how did that win the competition? We've got rice, what are we going to use to eat it?
Yeah.
How did two sticks win? But it's things like this, you know, that he's always been helping people.
Yeah.
And when he was working Eveready, he left Eveready because the factory was closed and he went to work for the council. When he was the council, he was a magistrate. So he became a magistrate, and then he's still helping people.
Right.
Okay. So he's always done these sorts of things.
Yeah. I suppose that's what you said earlier, is that because you kind of went, oh, well, I'm not. Where did I get it from? It's probably got it from my dad. That's where you got it from.
Yeah.
I'm not saying, like I say, I'm not saying.
Well, but there's so much evidence.
There's evidence suggests that you got it from your dad. So that experience of losing your dad, was it sudden? Was it sudden illness? And
he had a pacemaker for many years.
Yeah.
But then he developed cancer. One of the problems he had is that the treatment was affecting his pacemaker.
Right.
So in the end, they had to turn off the pacemaker.
Yeah.
And ultimately, his heart failed.
Yeah.
So it wasn't the cancer that took him; it was the treatment of the cancer that made him stop using the.
Yeah. And how did that affect you? His thing.
It's hard.
Yeah.
Very hard.
Yeah.
But one of the things.
Well, you would have had the support around you.
Yeah, one of the things that taught me is resolve.
Yeah.
Because your stepmum asked me, he said your dad wanted you to do the bidding prayers.
Yeah.
So and the church we went to, St. Cuthbert's Church, is where I went to on school, so that was our local parish church.
Yeah.
Held about 600 people.
Yeah.
Packed. And there's people outside as well.
So he's actually well known and yeah.
So I'm in there and I've been asked to do the bidding prayers.
Yeah.
And because of the way you're taught in the forces, you know that if you've got to do something, you've got to do it.
Yeah.
And you get on with it. And surely still can't believe to this day how I managed to do it.
Yeah.
Because you stood up there at the pew and got these bidding prayers, about five bidding prayers, and read them out to the whole congregation.
Yeah.
And it's just pure focus. I stood there, focused on the paper, because if I looked up and saw anybody, would have crumbled.
You'd have crumbled, yeah.
And there's a couple of things that got me on the way from the church down to the crematorium to the graveyard, because my dad was buried in the same grounds as the crematorium. Yeah. And there's one thing, there was an old chap stopped and took his hat off.
Yeah.
And another thing, a young girl about 17, 18 stopped and made the sign of the cross.
Yeah.
And simple little things like that.
Yeah.
You know, the small marks of respect.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they nearly tipped me over the edge.
Yeah, yeah.
The thing that did is when I got the earth and dropped on the coffin, I just crumbled then.
Yeah, yeah. So after all these years of, you know, like you said, it's quite often is we build up resilience from so many different things, and then it takes something like that for some people to make them, you know, crumble.
Yeah.
You know, particularly if they've been so close to that person as well. But obviously then you had Shirley around you, had
your
family around you to kind of get you through things. You must have celebrated his...
Celebrate.
You must have celebrated in because you've been a counsellor.
Yeah.
You like jokes. Your family must have, I mean, you almost have celebrated in that way, his life and...
I'll tell you the last selfless act that he did.
Yeah.
Last time I saw him was just before Christmas.
Yeah.
And he died on January the 2nd.
Yeah.
And he held on because he didn't want anybody to have to celebrate the anniversary of his death between Christmas and New Year.
Mm.
So he waited until January the 2nd.
Before.
And then he went.
Yeah.
And
So that's almost
I'm convinced he did that
yeah.
just to make sure everybody was left behind didn't have to remember it on this, over that period.
Over that period, because then, that's a good point there. Yeah. Good point. It's been mental health and people struggling with, say, bereavement, because that's, you've had that 7 years ago. And now you remember him every year and stuff like that. What would you say about people struggling with mental health? I mean, if they were, because you're a counsellor, you are a counsellor now. You talk, you open up. You've opened up on this podcast. What would you say to people who may be struggling with?
Talk to somebody. Don't hold it in. Don't keep it to yourself.
Yeah.
Don't hide it.
Yeah.
Speak to somebody. Find someone to talk to.
Yeah.
Somebody you know, somebody you don't know. Yeah. Doesn't matter. Just need to talk to somebody. I think a lot of the release is you actually vocalising it.
Yeah.
It's not the understanding of the other person. It's the fact that you're actually saying it. So it's taken basically the pressure that's inside your head.
Yeah.
As soon as you talk, it's releasing that pressure.
Yeah.
And I honestly think that's the biggest secret to people that have got these pent-up issues. Talk to somebody.
Yeah. And you would say, another thing, laughter. Laughter is always good for the soul.
Always.
Give us a few one-liners, a few jokes to take us out. I put you on the spot now. It's normally, is it improvise?
Normally I'm a reactive comedian.
Yes.
So I react to situations.
Yeah.
But one of my favourite stupid jokes, I have a pet newt. I call it Tiny. I called it Tiny because it's my news.
I think on that we'll end the podcast. Yeah, I mean, he's got many jokes, and I'd like to say thank you for coming on.
No problem.
Talking about,
thank you for inviting me, Andrew.
I know I spoke about your dad and things like that, but I think it's important that people who may be struggling, even throughout this last year, who may have gone through, like myself, who's gone through bereavement and things like that, it's important for them to like you say, open up.
Yeah.
And I also think
laughter is a wonderful tool. Wonderful.
Yes, I think it's brilliant, because even if somebody's going through things, as soon as you make them laugh, it can change the mannerisms.
Yeah, exactly.
And the smile. Thank you.
My pleasure.
And that was Men Are Nuts. Speak to you soon.